I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and hedge fund manager Peter Thiel. He's joined in conversation by technology journalist and author Sarah Lacey. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Peter Thiel and Sarah Lacey.
Good evening. I'm Stephanie Singer, manager of Arts and Ideas Lectures, and I'm delighted to host all of you for a terrific evening with Peter Thiel. So tonight we're going to do this. Peter's going to come out and speak on his own first, and then he'll sit down for a conversation with the wonderful award-winning journalist and founder and editor-in-chief of Pando Daily, Ms. Sarah Lacey. And finally, we'll open it up to questions from you, the audience. And then after the program ends, join Peter and co-author Blake Masters for a book signing in the atrium. Peter and Blake will gladly sign your copies of 0 to 1. Please know that the authors will not be personalizing or accepting new business proposals. Thank you. Our guest this evening is entrepreneur and investor Peter Thiel. Peter first gained attention for his attempt to replace the U.S. dollar by starting PayPal, which did not achieve that ultimate goal, but which did change the way payments work and made it possible for hundreds of thousands of small businesses to thrive on the internet. After taking PayPal public and then selling it to eBay, he has become known as the Don of the PayPal Mafia, since so many of his former colleagues have gone on to start successful companies, including SpaceX, Tesla Motors, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Yelp. In 2004, Peter himself started Palantir Technologies, a data analytics company that makes tools for national security and global finance. That same year, he also made the first outside investment in Facebook, where he continues to serve on the board of directors. Today, as a partner at Founders Fund and in his own investing, he works to identify and support the next generation of technology companies. He also started the Thiel Foundation and the 20 Under 20 Thiel Fellowship, helping to ignite a debate on the differences that might exist between learning and schooling. Despite his criticism of the education bubble, in the spring of 2012, Peter taught a class in the computer science department of his alma mater, Stanford University. He has now revised and written that class to make the new book called 0 to 1, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future, for which he is here this evening to discuss. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the one and only Peter Thiel.
Thank you very much for that that gracious introduction. There's so many different threads to talk about in this question of entrepreneurship and how to teach entrepreneurship, how to write about entrepreneurship. It's actually quite a difficult thing to write about or teach. I think there's sort of two standard ways that people go about it that I'm somewhat skeptical of. One is basically that you'd tell lots of stories about your own experience. And so it would be, this is what I did at PayPal in 99, 2000, how we combined email with money. And while these are sort of interesting stories, they don't really tell you that much about what you could be doing in 2014. And then I think at the other end of the spectrum is what I sort of describe as the pseudo-scientific approach, where it's a formula, you follow these five steps, and you will have a successful business. And the problem with that is also sort of the same, which is that every moment in the history of business happens only once. Every moment in the history of technology happens only once. The next Mark Zuckerberg will not be building a social networking site. The next Larry Page won't build a search engine. The next Bill Gates will not be building an operating system. And if you're trying to sort of copy these people, there's some sense in which you're not learning from them. And so the point of departure for me in 0 to 1 is this question: how do we build these great, one-of-a-kind, unique, new companies? And that's the question I get at in all these different ways. The sort of a contrarian question that I ask, which is, tell me, you know, what great business is nobody building? There's an intellectual version of this question. Tell me something that's true that very few people agree with you on. And this turns out to be a shockingly hard interview question. Even when people know that you're going to ask the question in advance, they can sort of read it on the internet that I asked this people. And it turns out to be a really hard question, I think, for two reasons. First off, that most of the time we think of truth as being conventional. Truth is just what everybody already agrees to be true. So it's very hard to come up with something new, and it sounds like you have to come up with some brilliant insight, which is really hard to do. But secondly, it's a very hard question because it often requires a certain amount of courage. You have to tell the person who's asking you something they may not have thought of or may not agree with or may not want to hear. And we live in a world in which I think courage is in even shorter supply than genius. And so my book, 0 to 1, gives a whole series of my answers to these questions, things that I believe to be true that most people do not agree with me on. And I thought I'd maybe just share three of those answers with you tonight. The first one, and this is in some ways the overarching theme of the book, is that and it comes out of this idea of building great, unique companies, is that most people believe that capitalism and competition are synonyms. I believe they're antonyms. I believe that a capitalist is someone who's in the business of accumulating capital. I believe a world of perfect competition is a world where all the profits are competed away. And so if you want to compete like crazy, you should open a restaurant in San Francisco. You will never make any money. And that's sort of my go-to example of a really bad idea. And I always have to be careful when I'm saying this in sort of a context where people are serving food or something like that. But then at the other end of the spectrum is something like Google is sort of the paradigm of a successful company where they have a fantastic monopoly in search. They've had no competition since 2002 when they definitively distanced themselves from Yahoo and Microsoft. And that is sort of a one-of-a-kind business. And that's the sort of thing that works. The opening line of Anna Karenina is all happy families are alike, all unhappy families are unhappy in their own special way. And I think the exact opposite is true of business. All happy companies are different because they found something unique that differentiates them, where they're the only ones that are doing it. All unhappy companies are the same because they fail to escape the essential sameness that is competition. The chapter in the book is entitled "All Happy Companies Are Different." When it was excerpted by the Wall Street Journal, they always have sort of the freedom to change the title, and they changed it from "All Happy Companies Are Different" to "Competition Is for Losers," which sort of had a little bit more of a punch. I would not have actually come up with it myself, but it had. And the reason that has such a punch, though, is because we always think of competition of the losers as the people who are not competing effectively enough. So you're a loser if you're the slow kid on the track team. You're a loser if you're not scoring quite high enough on standardized tests or grades to get into that Ivy League school. And we generally don't think of the people who are hyper-competitive, who are obsessed with competition, as somehow already have fallen into some sort of a trap of one sort or another. And I think this question of competition versus monopoly, one reason it's not understood is intellectual, because the people of monopolies don't talk about them. The people who are competing like crazy still always pretend that they're doing something unique. So if you're opening a restaurant in San Francisco, and you're trying to get investors, you won't say it's a terrible business, we're never going to make money. You will say, this will be the only British Nepalese fusion cuisine within a five block radius of the JCC. It'll be one of a kind. And so this question of monopoly versus competition always gets obscured in these ways. But I think there's also a psychological component that we're somehow we somehow end up being attracted to competition. We find it validating. And sort of the autobiographical part of this is that I personally was sort of hyper-tracked in all these ways. My eighth grade junior high school yearbook, one of my friends wrote in, you know, "Peter, I know you'll make it to Stanford as a sophomore in 4 years." And sure enough, I got to Stanford four or five years later. Then I went to Stanford Law School. And sort of everything, and I ended up, you know, at a big law firm in Manhattan. And it was sort of always sort of competing for the next credential. When you won the tournament, you went on to compete for the next thing afterwards. And sort of by the time I got to this law firm, it was, you know, it was sort of one of these strange dynamics where on the outside, everybody tried to get in. On the inside, everybody tried to leave. After I left, 7 months and 3 days, one of the people down the hall from me told me, "You know, Peter, it's really reassuring to see you go. I had no idea that it was possible to escape from Alcatraz," which of course, you know, all you had to really do was just go out the front door and not come back. But psychologically, this was incredibly hard to do because so much of the identity was wrapped up in having won these competitions, having won these tournaments, and so it was actually, you know, people really couldn't imagine leaving or going away from this. And I sort of think of myself as having had this sort of rolling quarter-life crisis during my 20s. I never got to midlife crisis. I just had a quarter-life crisis. And as I sort of became more and more disenchanted with the way competition had set me up to you either lose or you win at something that's not quite the right thing to win at. You know, when Henry Kissinger said that the battles in academia are so ferocious because the stakes are so small, you know, he was not describing. On one level, he was sort of describing the insanities of his fellow professors at Harvard, but on another level, but you'd say, well, you know, why would the battles be ferocious if the stakes are small? I mean, why fight if there's nothing at stake? But it's also, I think, follows directly from the logic of the situation, which is if the stakes are small, if the differences are small, then you have to fight even harder to somehow differentiate yourself from the other people, however small it might be. And you can sort of think of all these sort of Olympic athletic things where it's like a fraction of a second. You have to fight for tiny differences because that's the only thing that counts. And I think we always want to push very much against that. There's this very strange phenomenon in Silicon Valley, where so many of the great founders of these companies seem to be suffering from some mild form of Asperger's or something like this, and I think we should always turn this around into a critique of our society. And what is it about our society where someone who's not suffering from Asperger's, who is socially well adapted, will be talked out of all of their original, creative, heterodox ideas before those ideas are even fully formed, because they will sense in some subtle ways that people look at them in a funny way. Oh, that's weird. That's strange. What will people think of you? Why are you doing that? And you will have sort of been talked out of these ideas before you even have them. And I often think of business schools as sort of the anti-Asperger crowd tends to go to business school, and they've done these very interesting studies that, and I think a lot of the people there are very, very talented, but they've done these very interesting studies at Harvard Business School where you sort of have all these super extroverted people. Maybe they sort of are fairly low conviction. They don't really have any ideas, but they're very extroverted, and they're in a 2-year hothouse environment where they're talking to all these other people to figure out what to do next with their life, and people have found that systematically the largest sort of cohort always concludes that they should try to catch the last wave, and it's always the wrong idea. So, you know, 1989, they wanted to work for Michael Milken a few years before he went to jail for the junk bond stuff. they never were interested in tech except for 99, 2000 when they perfectly timed the top of the dot-com bubble. And 2005 to 2007, it was real estate, it was private equity. And so I do think the word ape already in the time of Shakespeare meant both primate and to imitate. And there is this very disturbing element of human nature that's sort of ape-like, sheep-like, lemming-like, herd-like. We learn by imitation. It's how we learn language as children. It's how culture gets transmitted. So there's a lot that's good about it. But then there are all these ways that I think it can also lead us very much astray. And so anyway, first big theme is I think we really should rethink competition from the ground up and really try to stay as far away from it as possible. Second sort of a theme in my book is this. There's always this question, when he asks, coming back to this question, tell me something that's true that very few people agree with you on. There's always a sense that people have that it's really hard to come up with answers. All the answers have already been discovered in one way or another. And I think that's not the case. And I sort of divide things up into conventions, which are things everybody knows to be true. At the other extreme, there are mysteries, things that nobody can figure out. And in between are these things that I call secrets, which are things that you could figure out. They're hard, but if you really work at it, you could figure something out. And one thought that I have is that there are many secrets left to be discovered. I actually think that this is a somewhat non-conventional view, because I think the conventional view is that most secrets have been discovered and that there's nothing new to find. And so, it is true of certain domains. So if you were growing up in the 17th or 18th century, you could have looked at the map of the world and there were some empty spaces on the map, and you could have become an explorer and discovered what was in those places. It would have been hard, pretty dangerous kind of a thing to do. In the 19th century, you could have done basic chemistry and discovered some new elements in the periodic table. And there's a way in which in the 21st century, geography or basic chemistry are not the places where you will find new secrets. These fields are sort of fully developed. They're sort of closed. There's nothing new to discover. But I think most things are not like that. And I think there are a lot of fields where new things can be found. We're often discouraged by sort of a version of globalization. We think there are 7 billion other people in the world, and there will always be someone who will have already thought of it. And if no one will have thought of it before us, it must be almost impossibly hard. And so it ends up being this sort of self-fulfilling thing where we don't even try. And I do think the only people who will discover secrets are people who work at it and who try doing it. And I think that many of these great companies have something like this at the core. It's some domain of knowledge, some area where people think they can figure out a lot more. At PayPal, we were very interested in this, in the intersection of money and cryptography. Could you create a new digital currency on the internet? And it was a fairly idiosyncratic field. There were small number of people working on it. There was this financial cryptography community, and you could sort of understand the field. You could get to the frontiers, and you could explore it quite a bit more. And so I think the second idea I want to leave you with is there still is a frontier left, and the frontier is not infinitely far away. There's certain places where the frontier has been closed, so geographically it's kind of closed. But there are many places where you can still get to the frontier, and it's actually there are many directions you can go where the frontier is close and where there's a lot left to be discovered. Let me end with a third, somewhat contrarian idea, and this is a little bit bigger picture. One of the things that I contrast in 0 to 1. Are two different modes of progress, and I think we will need both of these in the 21st century. One mode of progress is globalization. It's horizontal growth. It's copying things that work. It's going from one to N. It's extensive growth, And I think China is sort of the paradigm of globalization today. All that China has to do in the next decade or two is just copy things that work from the U.S. and Western Europe. They can skip a few steps, but it's all really, really straightforward on some level.
You're listening to entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and hedge fund manager Peter Thiel. He's joined in conversation by Sarah Lacey on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And I think the other mode of progress is, I always draw it on a y-axis, is vertical, intensive growth. It's technology. It's going from zero to one. It's doing new things. And I sort of draw them on these separate axes to underscore that technology and globalization are two very different kinds of concepts, even though they're always used interchangeably. And if we look back over the last 200 years, there have been periods of technology. There have been periods of globalization. And you can sort of see that they don't necessarily overlap. The 19th century, 1815 to 1914, you had both tremendous globalization and tremendous technological progress. 1914, after World War I, globalization sort of goes in reverse. There's less trade, less finance. The world becomes a less connected place. And I would argue it becomes more and more disconnected. Maybe until 71 when Kissinger goes to China and globalization restarts in earnest. Technology keeps going super fast for most of the 20th century. It is my view that it has actually decelerated some in the last four decades, where we've had tremendous progress in computers, internet, mobile internet, the world of bits, somewhat less in a lot of other areas. So we have less progress in energy or transportation or medicine or space travel, or all the futuristic things people envisioned in the 50s and 60s. And so so the 20th century, the last 100 years, have been the first part. 1914 to 71 was a period of runaway technology, but globalization went in reverse. And 1971 to the present was a period when globalization was on overdrive and technology happened, but only in this narrow cone around computers and not much else. And I think this sort of weird shift that's happened is reflected in the way in which we talk about the world. In the 1950s and 1960s, you would have divided the world into the first world and the third world. The first world was that part of the world that saw accelerating technological progress. The third world was that part that was sort of permanently screwed up. Today we would talk about the developing and the developed world. And this is a pro-globalization sort of convergence theory of history account, where the developing countries are those countries that are copying the developed world and will become more like them in the decades ahead. So it's a convergence theory. But it also implicitly is an anti-technology dichotomy, because when we say that we're living in the developed world, we're implicitly saying that we're living in that part of the world where nothing new is going to happen, where things are basically finished, and where we can expect decades of relative stagnation, where the younger generation should not expect to be better off than their parents and maybe will be worse off. And I think we should push back very strongly on that label. And so I would end with the contrarian question that I think we should ask a lot more of, you know, how do we go about developing the so-called developed world? Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. It's a packed house. That was fantastic. You can see I have the limited edition orange cover of your book because I got it early and devoured it and loved it. I have so many things I want to ask you. I want to start out. One of the things that I love that you said and you repeated it tonight is courage is in shorter supply than genius. And it's certainly something I've seen. There's so many people who are genius founders who don't build the biggest companies. And there are people who don't seem that extraordinarily genius or talented that either work harder, don't believe things, don't take note, that do. I feel like a lot of the last 5 years in the Valley, though, has been about trying to lower the barriers to become an entrepreneur, that the world should be more entrepreneur-friendly. We should have more incubators. We should make it cheaper and easier for people to start companies. You know, it shouldn't be this hard to start a company. Do you think that's a bad force because it's inherently bringing more people into this who aren't having to prove courage to even get in the door?
Well, I don't think it's bad in itself. So I don't think we should have... I think whenever you reduce barriers, that's... All else being equal, that is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's always a danger. You know, I'm always nervous about crowds. I don't think there's wisdom in crowds. I think there's insanity and madness to be found in crowds. And so when you have a gold rush mentality where everyone comes to Silicon Valley in an undifferentiated way, that can be problematic. And so the label that I always think we should really be careful about is this entrepreneur label. I was talking to one of my friends a few years ago and was asking, so what do you want to be doing in 5-10 years' time? It's really clear, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. And that's like saying, I'm going to be rich, I'm going to be famous. You shouldn't think of an entrepreneur as a line item on a resume where you're building some thin app-like company, and if that fails, it probably will, you will go to Harvard Business School. I think you have to be a little bit crazy to really start a company. It's kind of a psychically exhausting thing. It's a manic depressive experience. And so I think you should try to have good reasons for doing it. And you start companies not in order to become an entrepreneur, but in order to solve problems that otherwise are not going to be solved, that for some reason can't be solved within large institutions, governments, large corporations, large nonprofits.
Yeah, this is one of the only places where you can actually be at a cocktail party and someone asks you what you do for a living and you say you're an entrepreneur, even though you're not building a company.
Yeah, so that's...
Like people will just self-identify as an entrepreneur, even though they're not actually doing something.
Well, you have to ask what they're doing. So in Silicon Valley, you have to at least ask a follow-up question.
Yeah, is there actually a company?
In most other parts of the world, if you say it, it's like, it's too bad you couldn't cut it at a regular job.
Right. One of the beautiful and horrible things about the Valley. So to the point about crowds, there's been a lot of debate, I mean, really since I think Facebook was valued at $100 million by Excel, of whether or not we're in another bubble. I know you and I have had conversations about this many times over the years, but more recently, there's been a lot of talk because private company valuations are big. I mean, it's no longer a billion-dollar club. It's a $5 or $10 billion club. And some VCs recently, like Fred Wilson and Bill Gurley, have come out and said, the problem isn't valuations, it's burn rates. And we're legitimately worried about burn rates and how crazy they're getting, and that is a bad sign. It strikes me as the entrepreneur reading that, that it's a little self-serving for a VC to say the problem is burn rates when they're writing those checks. Do you think either are a bad sign, and where do you come down on that?
Yeah, so it may or may not be self-serving. I'm always just more interested, is it true or not?
Right.
For the record, I don't think we're in a bubble at all. I think that I'll give sort of the simple version is... I think these bubbles were psychosocial phenomena, and whether you had a dot-com bubble or a housing bubble, these things involved the entire public. And this time around, the public is broadly not involved, and it's because the companies don't IPO till very, very late. And so there may be 30 or 40 tech IPOs a year versus, I don't know, something like 300 a year in the late 90s. And so to first approximation, the public has not been involved. I do think there still is this residual hangover from the late 90s. I think that one of the things that characterizes it, people they still always raise plenty of money to have a large cushion. And so I think the way to think of burn rate is not in absolute dollars, how many dollars are you burning each month, but how long is the runway? Mm-hmm. And almost all of the larger companies that I see have, comfortably 2 years of runway or more.
Right.
And so I think there are very few that get to any stage where they run out. Mm-hmm. The final thought I would have is that, you know, if there is a bubble in the U.S. today, you know, because we had, you know, we had a tech one in the 90s, you had a crazy bubble in Japan in the 80s, you had a, you know, finance housing one in the last decade. So it's not unreasonable to think maybe there's another bubble going on. You know, my candidate for the bubble would be in government bonds, the money printing, and that it's somehow centered on government, which is, you know, it's very weird. It's hard to say exactly how that ends. But if it's government bonds that are in the bubble, then the assets you want to be careful of are things that are close to government bonds. Mm-hmm. Corporate bonds, maybe housing because it's linked to interest rates, maybe stocks that pay high dividends because you model those. They're sort of like bonds, value stocks. Mm-hmm. Whereas the tech stocks are actually the main component of the valuation of a high-growth Silicon Valley tech stock is not the risk-free rate of interest, mm-hmm. but the growth rate. And I actually think there is a bubble in bonds, and because I'm really scared of it, I have 3/4 of my net worth tied up in illiquid tech stocks in Silicon Valley because that's as far as you can get from the real bubble that's going on.
Interesting. And that's where a lot of people think the bubble is. I mean, it's the illiquid tech stocks, you know, that have the valuations
that freak people out. That's where I'm hiding from the bubble.
Always contrarian. So there are two things I want to make sure we talk about. One is about the battle between Uber and Lyft. Now, I was fascinated reading in your book because you write over and over again, and you talked about it tonight with competition, that it is a bad area to be investing in companies where it is a war for buying customers, where there's no discernible difference between the two companies, where, you know, it is, you can't be a monopoly because you have huge amounts of money and companies chasing the same customer essentially in the same ways with the same product. Now, I started out as an Uber customer. I think Lyft is morally sort of a better company. But the big reason I started using Lyft was I noticed, the big reason I didn't is I thought the mustaches and fist bumping was cheesy. The big reason I started using it is I realized every Uber I got in San Francisco also had a Lyft phone, that there actually was no difference between the two markets. And so I might as well go with the company that I thought was less morally reprehensible. Now, you know, ultimately, how do you feel as an investor in Lyft? Because it seems to rebut everything that you say about why competition is so damaging with diminishing returns.
I'm an investor in Lyft, so that's full disclosure. And I have been on record as agreeing with you and saying that I think Uber is the most ethically challenged company. And you have to understand that I'm extremely biased, so discount those biases. I think that... I do think that when you have these competitive dynamics, people end up often doing, behaving in really, really bad ways. Competition brings out the worst in people. So when you have, I'll use sort of the positive example. When you have a company like Google have the slogan "Don't be evil," mm-hmm. people often say, "Oh, that's just this cheesy marketing thing. That's just propaganda." But I think it's more than that. I think having sort of all sorts of very high ethical standards, where you pay people way above market, you treat everybody far better than you have to. In some ways, that's easy to do if you're Google. It's much harder to do if you're, say, operating a restaurant in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there is something about the Uber Lyft dynamic that's like this. I would say that, again, just if you sort of think of this in relative terms, you know, we're investors in Airbnb. Airbnb had a valuation of $10 billion. Uber has a valuation of $18 billion. It strikes me that Airbnb should be worth far more than Uber because of the, you know, Airbnb has no real competition. Uber has lots of competition. And so I think that's a clear mispricing in the market. Hmm. I think one of the, you know, there always are these... psychological blind spots we have, and I always like to focus on what they are. And I think one of the biases investors have is that they always like things. They like companies where they will use the product themselves.
Yeah.
And so the investors are very biased pro Uber because they like being driven around in black town cars.
They don't have to have cheesy pink mustaches or fist bump the driver.
And so they undervalue Lyft. They overvalue Uber. They undervalue something like Airbnb because people who are in the investor class tend to stay in five-star hotels.
Right.
They tend not to do the couch surfing.
And would not let anyone stay in their house.
And typically they don't let people stay in their houses.
Would you let someone stay in your house?
I've let people stay in my house, but I'm careful. Sometimes they don't leave, you know? It's dangerous.
Sean Parker stayed for quite a few years,
He stayed for about... He stayed at various people's houses, but yeah, mine was one of them for about a year.
The one thing that's super interesting that you touched on with your description of Uber is this issue that companies... And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but from what I read, it seems like you believe companies should have an ethical or moral center. Now, I think what's interesting about that, and you write about it in the book, is it's another one of these things. Everyone knows you as the Silicon Valley libertarian. Like, you are the action figure of the Silicon Valley libertarian that people point to and say, that's the guy who's going to make libertarian mainstream. And it's the first time the guys with the crazy libertarian ideas have all the money, and you're the poster child, and they point to Seasteading. Now, what you describe in terms of there should be ethical and moral responsibilities for companies isn't classically what we think of as libertarian. You know, there's a lot of other things in your book where you talk about the value of people doing a job versus machines. Distaste with the word disruption. You say at one point Ayn Rand was a half-good writer because I think she got the villains right but the heroes wrong. I mean, you take a lot of pot shots at what people consider classic libertarian, at least caricatures in this book. So I'd love to ask you, you know, and Travis Kalanick is another caricature, and you clearly don't like what he's doing at Uber. So I'd love to ask you, do you really identify as a Silicon Valley libertarian, or is that a label we've all put on you? And what does that mean?
Oh, these labels are always tricky. You know, I'm socially liberal, fiscally conservative, politically. But, if you ask me about my politics, mm-hmm. I'm more of a political atheist in that I just don't believe any of it very much. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to tell people you're a libertarian than to say that you're a political atheist, because that sounds really weird. But that's probably gets closer to temperamentally how I think about it.
it's always a bad idea, but if there is something that I find kind of sterile, if it's about nothing but making money, and mm-hmm. so it's far more inspiring if there's some transcendent goal, if there's some great friendships that come out of it. You know, when we started PayPal, you know, one of the goals was we want to create some fantastic friendships here that will survive the company, and mm-hmm. I think that helped, you know, generate this sense. And so I do think trying to reduce it to dollars and cents, you always end up missing a lot. One of the questions I always like people when they're starting companies is I always like asking the prehistory question. Mm-hmm. What were you doing? You know, when did you meet? What was the prehistory of this company? And a bad answer to the prehistory question is, we met at a networking event for entrepreneurs a week ago, and we decided we both wanted to start a company. It didn't matter really what it did. We decided to start one. That would be like, you know, getting married to the first person at the slot machines in Vegas. You know, you might hit the jackpot, probably a bad idea. I think sort of much better answers are, you know, we've been good friends for a few years. Maybe I'm more on the business side. The other mm-hmm. one's more on the tech side. And that's sort of a good answer. Now, you know, I wouldn't really give it a political characterization. I just think that's what works. And I think, I think focusing too much on money in startups doesn't work because there's no money. There's nothing there at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's people. You know, it's the way my friend Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn puts it is, if you're starting a company, it's like you have to convince a whole bunch of people of something fictitious that does not yet exist. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to convince enough people of it and they believe it, then they'll work at it and it will become real.
Mm-hmm. This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and hedge fund manager Peter Thiel. He's joined in conversation by Sarah Lacey. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So last thing, and then I want to try to get some questions from the audience. Man, I, in the margin of the book, I took a lot of notes during this book. It's also hilarious. It is actually laugh out loud funny. I would be on planes and I would start cracking up and people would look over and be like, there must be something inside that Peter Thiel book because there's no way it's that funny. It actually is. But you write about the demise of HP at one point and how they started turning into a services business and how that really eroded a lot of the value of the company. But one thing that jumped out at me was you talked about the chairwoman of the board, Patricia Dunn, and she argued that charting a plan for future technology was beyond the board's competence. The board should restrict itself to a night watchman's role. Was everything proper in the accounting department? Were people following all of the rules? I thought it was such a damning and accurate indictment of where boards of publicly traded tech companies just don't seem to be doing what we think boards should do. And, you know, I think we've seen this at Yahoo. I think we've seen this at, you know, a lot of these big tech companies. I'm curious what you think the role of a board member at a publicly traded tech company should be if it's not that. And is there anything that can be done to change that? Because I think a lot of forward-thinking technologists don't want to be on a public company board.
Well, I think in some ways it's a downside to going public. So again, I think the lateness of the IPOs is a healthy development versus the 90s. So once a company goes public, you often end up empowering a lot of the wrong people. They get sort of more power and people who maybe focus on longer term questions often get somewhat weaker when you know the quarterly earnings cycle starts to dominate things. I would say that there is. You, obviously, you want the accounting to be accurate. You don't want creativity in accounting. But I think there is some balance between process and substance. And I tend to think that we live in a world that's moved way too far in the process direction, and that's not focused enough on substance. Mm-hmm. And so I think sort of always a good thing is, you know, long substance, short status, short prestige, you know, there's always enough process, but just go long on substance.
Right. All right, let's get some questions from the audience. Well, one person asks, who's smarter, Peter Thiel or Elon Musk?
It's a terrible, terrible.
I know both of you. Do you want me to answer?
Elon is, there are ways in which I could never do what Elon's done, which is, you know, he's setting aside the IQ question. I think, you know, he's willing to take far more risk than I ever would. And what was very impressive about Elon with Tesla and SpaceX was, you know, he made maybe $250 million on PayPal and basically put all the money back.
$180 million, I think, between
something like that. So he put all the money back into those companies, and there's a degree to which, you know, I'm not willing to do that. And that's probably the big difference.
Someone once described, I think it was Jason Calacanis, described it as Elon is missing the fear chip.
There was a book on, I had thought once of writing a book on PayPal, and the chapter on Elon was going to be entitled The Man Who Knows No Risk. There were all these sort of crazy anecdotes, but there was one where we, in March of 2000, we had just merged Confinity and X.com, which the two companies combined to become PayPal. We had $15 million in the bank. The burn rate was $10 million a month. And we decided to, we drove out to Sequoia to brainstorm on how to raise some money. Elon had made $15 million in a previous startup. I think $12 million had gone into X.com. Of the other $3 million, $1 million had been spent on a McLaren X1 sports car. We decided.
The story gets better.
We drove the sports car out. It was on. We were supposed to prep for the meeting, but we just spent all our time talking about the car. It was the fastest car in the world.
Driving down 280.
Right? He'd taken up to 180 miles per hour on 280, which is kind of fast. But anyway, we sort of got on Sand Hill Road past Santa Cruz as you're heading out to 280. It's sort of this four-lane, two lanes each way, 35-mile zone. And it was time for the demo. And the car was accelerated from 45 to 85. The lanes were changed. There was enough torque that we lost, Elon sort of lost control. The car skidded. We hit the embankment, sort of rotated up. It was about 4 to 6 feet of airspace between the car and the road, sort of an unidentified flying object over Sand Hill Road. And it crashed into the side of the road. The first woman who stopped said she didn't really want to stop because she didn't want to deal with dead people. It looked that bad from the outside. And Elon's first comment to me was, wow, Peter, that was really intense. And it was, I'd read all these stories about people who made lots of money and spent it on sports cars and crashed them, but I knew that would never happen to me, so I had no insurance. And so we hitchhiked the rest of the way to the meeting.
Now, his version of the story is that you say, so how fast can this baby go?
That might have, it's not inconsistent. That's not inconsistent with my
saying,
version.
You are the instigator.
It's not inconsistent.
Okay, if you lost everything and you had to build back your current wealth, how would you go about investing?
Well, it's hard to invest if you've lost everything. So.
Well, we'll give you, a tiny bit. Like, what would you like? 100 grand. Say you're left with 100 grand.
I think I answered earlier. I would still try to do something in the tech side in Silicon Valley. I would try to do things where I had really high conviction. One of the things that's very tricky about angel investing or investing in Silicon Valley is the temptation you always have is to say that you can't know what's going to happen and to treat all the investments and all the people you're investing in as lottery tickets. And while I don't question that there's a role for chance and that you can't always predict what's going to happen, I found that psychologically, when I think that it's all a matter of luck, that the people I'm investing in are lottery tickets, that's always a terrible mindset to have because mm-hmm. It's sort of, once you start thinking that it's a lottery ticket, you've already psyched yourself into losing money and you wanna, and so it's always much better to try to get to a point of super high conviction, and so I think we often say things are a matter of luck when we're too lazy to really think things through. So whenever we say
or take a stand, sometimes it's the courage thing.
I would try to do the tech investing, but with the high conviction, not the spray and pray approach.
All right, you said backstage you didn't want to pick a new fight, but I'm hoping this will be an exception. Someone wants to know what your thoughts are about Snapchat and its creator.
Well, I've never met the guy who started it.
Not even when Facebook was trying to buy him for $3.5 billion.
I was not involved in that conversation. I think that I don't know. I think that these. There's always a tendency, I think it's going to be a very viable business for quite a while. It's possible that a number of companies, Facebook included, have slightly miscalibrated things on the privacy side. There's this constant complaint that people don't have quite enough privacy, And the computer age has sort of gone between these sort of transparency and privacy, alternated. And so in the late 90s, people thought everything was going to be the cypherpunks. Everything was going to be super encrypted and private. Mm-hmm. And today in 2014, we're at the opposite end of the spectrum where everything's going to be super transparent. And so I think there's a lot of room for the pendulum to swing back somewhat towards privacy, and there is a way in which Snapchat is a reasonably good expression of that. We always tend to be very biased against companies where the valuations go up super fast.
Right.
And one of the reasons we're always biased against them from the venture capital side is you sort of think about, there was sort of a whole series of financing rounds. So I think there was the one that IVP did in Snapchat. I think it was 2012. at a $750 million valuation. Mm-hmm. And at the time, everyone said, oh, that's ridiculously high.
Right.
Now, you know, you can debate whether it's worth $5 billion or $10 billion or more today. But today, 2 years later, it definitely looks like the IVP round was a great investment.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to think about is there were probably 10 other VC firms that didn't participate in that round. And so they're all going to be biased to saying 750 was too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's $3 billion or $5 billion, everyone's really lost their mind.
Right.
And so so certainly the contrarian perspective would be that, you know, and so the only debate you have about Snapchat today is that it's insanely overvalued or maybe fairly valued. And certainly the contrarian thing, which I'm not going to necessarily articulate, but it would be just that maybe it's still cheap.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, certainly in a world of WhatsApp, that might be a possibility. All right, let's ask a very techie, science-y question, because it's your wheelhouse. Is the recent revival of artificial intelligence and deep learning a hype? And if not, which are the most important problems AI can solve in the future?
I sort of go back and forth on this AI question. We've invested in a series of companies. We're investors in Vicarious. We invested in a company called DeepMind, which Google just acquired for quite a bit. And so I do think that if AI happens, this would be it would be the most important event in the history of the world. I mean, it would be on par with aliens landing on this planet. And so there's a way in which we probably underestimate how strange it would be. And so if you, you know, if you had, and you know, so we, it's always framed as, or the computer's going to take our jobs, and
right.
what will people do? And you know, if aliens landed on this planet, the first question would not be about the economy. It would be, you know, are they friendly? Are they unfriendly? It would be a political, not an economic question. And so I do think there are ways in which AI is such a strange phenomenon that we're probably underestimating it. That said, my intuition on timing is that it's probably still further in the future than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. So that's sort of. So on the one hand, I think it's more important than people think. On the other, I think it's probably still further away.
You have a great section in your book about that sort of paranoia that machines are going to take the jobs. And you know, one of my favorite parts is you talk about how all of this time and money and research was spent on an algorithm that could look at YouTube and tell with, you know, something like 90% certainty if something was a cat, when, you know, a 3-year-old can do that flawlessly.
Yeah, so obviously, look, it's scary if you could build a computer that's smarter and better at you at everything.
Yeah.
That's economically scary. It's, you know, politically even scarier, I would say. But I think the reality is that computers and people are good at extremely different kinds of things, and that's why it's fundamentally a story of complementarity and not substitution. And the way this falls into my whole competition theme is, you know, the things you should be scared of are people who are just like you. This is why there's sort of a naive intuition that people have that you should be a little bit scared of cloning. So if you could mm-hmm. have 100 clones of you
right.
that are identical to you,
I'd be thrilled.
And
I could just take the day off.
And they were willing to work for nothing, and they try to take your job. There's some point where you get kind of nervous, and that's why you know, I think globalization, even though I'm in
yeah.
favor of globalization, there are these challenges because the people in India and China are not that different from people in Japan or Western Europe or the U.S., and they can substitute for us. And so globalization does put a lot of pressure on middle-class wages.
Mm-hmm.
I think computers are just really different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's certain repetitive tasks where it'll free people up, so there no longer are tellers and bank machines with
right.
you know, ATM machines, but there are, you know, far more people working in banks as, you know, financial consultants and advisors. So I think the story of technology is generally one of freeing people up to do other things
mm-hmm.
because the computers and humans are, they're really much more complements than substitutes.
Well, we have to stop, unfortunately. Sorry to not get to more of your questions. They were all really good. Seriously, it is, I mean, don't let this somewhat boring cover fool you. It is absolutely hilarious.
Don't judge a book by its cover.
Brilliant. Yes, exactly. Fortunately, I didn't, and I read it. But it is absolutely brilliant and hilarious, and much like having dinner with Peter Thiel, which is one of my favorite people to have dinner with in Silicon Valley. So thanks a lot, and he'll sign for you afterwards.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and hedge fund manager Peter Thiel. He was joined in conversation by Sarah Lacey. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finlay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt. Here's a preview.
Speaking of confusion about my intentions. A pretty girl is like a minstrel show. It makes you laugh, it makes you cry, you go. It just isn't the same on radio. It's all about the makeup and the dancing and the oh, a pretty girl is like a violent crime. If you do it wrong, you could do time. But if you do it right, it is sublime. I'm so in love with you, girl. It's like I'm on the moon. I can't really breathe, but I feel lighter. A melody is like a pretty girl. Who cares if it's the dumbest in the world? It's all about the way that it unfurls. A pretty girl is like a pretty girl.
That was a preview of next week's Bina, when we will feature songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt, whose new book is 101 Two-Letter Words. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.